From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I mean, Martinez, it is Friday, but with news this week, it feels like it's got to be 2020 already, but no, it is still only just 2019 February. Long way to go before this year's up. All right, coming up, we'll visit one of the ugliest buildings in town.
You see jutting forms, you see cantilevered balconies, you see corrugated metal. It really is a mixture of a lot of different things going on.
Find out what building we're talking about later in today's show. First, though, State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, President Trump has declared a national emergency to unlock more money for border barriers. California's response, see you in court. Meanwhile, those headlines you saw about California axing the high-speed rail, well, Governor Newsom says it's all one big misunderstanding. We'll have all those stories. And hey, we'll even look at Senator Kamala Harris and something called Reefergate. Yeah, we'll explain all of that with Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Hello, Carla.
Hello, A. Good to be with you.
Also with us, Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Happy Emergency Day.
that is a good way to frame that. Carla, so let's start off with this clip of President Trump today after announcing he'll declare that national emergency, as Jack Pitney so eloquently mentioned, to fund his border wall.
And we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling.
And actually, he goes on like that for another 20 seconds. Carla, how have California lawmakers responded to this move by the president?
Well, they immediately seized on the one quote that you didn't put in there where he said, I didn't need to do this.
Yeah.
And Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi on Twitter went after the president, and she and Chuck Schumer, of course, were out there immediately saying the president's actions clearly violate the Congress's exclusive powers. But then there was Governor Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Javier Becerra. They didn't waste any time. Almost as soon as the president was out of the Rose Garden there, they were behind the mic in Sacramento announcing that California is planning to sue the Trump administration over this declaration. And this, by the way, is Becerra's 46th lawsuit against the Trump administration. Basically, Newsom said Donald Trump is not the last word and the courts are going to have the last word. But we should mention, you know, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield came forward and said he supports the president's move. He said this is a national security crisis, a humanitarian crisis on the border, and has to be addressed. So we had a little of both on both sides of the aisle, A.
And the safety is off of Becerra's trigger when it comes to filing lawsuits against the Trump administration. I mean, he's got it ready to rock anytime. Now, Jack, just to put a number on it, President Trump is trying to secure, what, about $6.5 billion more than Congress approved on Thursday, and the president made no mention of that spending bill. Before we get lost, though, in this national emergency news, the spending bill is pretty significant. The president signed it, and it helps avert another shutdown. Is it odd to you, Jack, that the president signed a spending bill and then declared a national emergency pretty much at the same time?
Yeah, that is strange. The spending bill does avert a shutdown. It does provide a considerable chunk of change for border security, although not in the format that Trump requested. And as Carla pointed out, if he didn't need to do it, that doesn't make it very much of an emergency. But not only that, after he signed the bill, he took off for a weekend at a golf resort, which doesn't really sound like much of an emergency either. Now, I don't know whether courts will take cognizance of these things, but politically, it's a very bad look.
Well, and that is part of the discussion, right, Jack? I even heard on NPR this morning talking about how the president started off by talking about the trade deal with China before, yeah, at the end, we'll get to that national emergency thing that I'm about to announce. So, yeah, there is a bit of a definition crisis when it comes to the national emergency, depending on what side you're on.
That's right. And again, the legal definition is different. And even though it might not look like an emergency to a layperson, you could see how judges might possibly uphold this. But there are a ton of legal issues between here and the building of the first inch of wall.
Carla, okay, so this filing unlocks $8 billion. The White House goal is to build about 234 miles of new barriers. Where is this money coming from? And what will it do to address security at the border?
Well, if you remember, early on, there was alarm in California when the Trump administration said it was eyeing this pot of about $14 billion in Army Corps of Engineer money that was supposed to go for flood control, maybe in California and Puerto Rico. Representative John Garamendi kind of put a stop to that, introduced a bill that prevented the president from doing that. So what we have is Trump's acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, in a call with reporters today, basically said the plan is to allocate $8 billion to wall construction, of which only $1.4 billion was included in that spending bill. And the rest are going to come from three separate pots. You've got about $600 million coming from the Treasury Department drug-related forfeitures. You've got about $2.5 from Defense Department Drug Prevention Fund, and another $3.6 billion, which is the biggest chunk, from a military construction fund. So right now, it's a, you know, there's a whole a range of money coming forward. The compromise bill, funding bill, of course, passed both houses of Congress overwhelmingly. Interestingly enough, Senator Kamala Harris was one of only five Democrats in the Senate to vote against it.
And Carly, we know it's all this money specifically just going for the construction of the barrier, or are there other parts of it?
Construction and it appears, you know, drug prevention efforts. Remember, the president said in his press conference today, insisted that the drug enforcement issues are all along the wall, even though he was challenged to say where his statistics are coming from. U.S. law enforcement says it's the ports of entry that are the problem and has really nothing to do with the wall. But the president sort of sidestepped that question. So right now it's a little bit of both drug enforcement and the actual wall construction.
And Jack, as we mentioned earlier, Gavin Newsom says the state plans to sue. New York's AG also has vowed to fight back, saying it's going to use every legal tool at its disposal. Nancy Pelosi also could bring up something called a joint resolution of termination. What could happen, Jack, if she does that?
Okay, well, it would have to pass both chambers, and it would be subject to a presidential veto, which obviously would be forthcoming, in which case Congress could override the veto by 2/3 vote. That seems pretty unlikely. However, this is something that the courts might take notice of. There's a famous Supreme Court case during the Truman administration where Justice Jackson wrote, when the president takes measures incompatible with the expressed or implied will of Congress, his power is at its lowest ebb. So that might give a little ammunition to those who are challenging this in court, even if he ends up vetoing it.
Now, Carla, all right, so this joint resolution of termination would face slim odds, but I can imagine that the president will face a barrage of legal challenges in the coming weeks. Any chance, though, that the challenges could prevent him from tapping those funds until maybe after 2020?
If you're talking about the challenge by, for instance, Becerra and Newsom,
yeah.
There are some legal experts saying that even still that might not be that easy, that there is this 1976 federal law called the National Emergency Act that recognizes the presidential authority to declare a national emergency. And as Jack mentioned, Congress can overrule that. But you need 2/3 majority to override an almost certain veto there. And in the Supreme Court, if it got to the Supreme Court, well, that's not maybe perhaps they haven't been so eager to place roadblocks in the path of the president. So it could be a toss-up here, eh?
And Governor Newsom said this declaration harms the state. Let's listen to that.
And the irony of this is the actual work that was effective, the actual work that is responsible and responsive to the real and legitimate concerns around fentanyl and methamphetamine, heroin, and cocaine, that is being done within the state of California is now being put at risk for a vanity project, for a monument to stupidity.
Jack, how unique are California's concerns in this?
Well, California does share concerns with some other states, and the grounds of some objection could cover several different issue areas. As the governor suggested, this plan might divert money from projects that would benefit California. Though, as Carla just said, it's not yet clear exactly what the pots of money will be. Second, environmental damage. One is almost certain to find that California and perhaps other states will argue that the wall would cause great environmental damage, not only water flow, but endangered species. It could also cause economic damage to property owners. And in that case, the suit would not only just be state governments, but the property owners themselves. So this is a bonanza for lots of lawyers all along the Southwest border.
You know what? I will say, guys, that ever since the election, and America, I think, has seen really the inner workings of the political machine more than any other time in history. I would imagine. I mean, we're seeing the guts of this thing, this machine, work at its biggest level.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to move on in a second. We're doing State of Affairs. Carla Marinucci is senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. All right, Carla, keeping with Governor Newsom, at his State of the State earlier this week, he dropped a lot of surprises, including one regarding the future of high-speed rail. This is what he said.
Right now, there simply isn't a path to get from Sacramento to San Diego, let alone from San Francisco to L.A. I wish there were. However, we do have the capacity to complete a high-speed rail link between Merced and Bakersfield.
And this is the AP headline that came out of it. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced Tuesday he's abandoning a plan to build the high-speed rail line between L.A. and San Francisco. I also saw headlines, Carla, the rail gets killed. I mean, all kinds of different things that have described its death, maybe premature. How did so many people get this wrong, Carla?
Well, you know, a month into his term, Gavin Newsom is getting a hard lesson in communications here. You know, when he started out at the State of the State saying, let's be real, let's talk about high-speed rail, everyone's ears perked up. And then he gave that message about, look, we can't do it all. Remember, this is a project that's $44 billion over budget, 13 years behind schedule. And he talked about more transparency is needed. But the fact is, a lot of people came away from that speech with those headlines you talked about. It's over. It's done. Put a fork in it. And that put, you know, his team on damage control. Ann O'Leary, his chief of staff, was on Twitter saying Governor Newsom is fully committed to high-speed rail in all of California. He's had to really kind of walk it back in terms of getting out his message. He's saying, look, I'm scaling it down. I'm making it more transparent. I want more accountability. And right now there's no plan to get us over the Tehachapis or from the Central Valley to Silicon Valley. But he seems to be suggesting, I'm going to keep trying, but right now let's concentrate on what we can do. And that kind of sort of nuanced message doesn't make it into headlines or into a 280-character Twitter.
Who would have thought that the bullet train and Mark Twain would have something in common, right? No one would have ever predicted that. Jack, it wasn't long before President Trump then tweeted demanding that California return about $3.5 billion. Can he do that?
Not exactly. Just to follow what Carla was saying about Central Valley, there is a statutory deadline, but it doesn't kick in till December of 2022. Now, that focuses on the Central Valley portion of the project. Now, if that part of the construction isn't done by the deadline, the feds might be able to withhold funds, but it's not the case that right now Trump can simply demand that he write a check. But the statutory deadline is why it makes a heck of a lot of sense to focus on Central Valley and put the other portions of it on hold for a while.
All right, Carla, one last thing before we break for the weekend. It involves Senator turned presidential hopeful Kamala Harris and something that's been dubbed Reefergate. What is Reefergate, Carla?
Well, to be blunt, this is a chronic.
Wow, you topped Jack. Jack just had a great one at the top of the segment, and you just, well, you might have a chance to beat her, Jack. But go ahead, Carla, start it off.
Yeah, I mean, look, Kamala Harris went on a popular radio show, and she was asked about her past cannabis use. And essentially she said, and I'm paraphrasing here, are you kidding? I'm half Jamaican, of course. And I did inhale back in college. This shows how much times has have changed. I mean, she was even asked about her playlist when she smoked, and she said Tupac and Snoop Dogg. That's when the investigative teams of major media went into a frenzy because Tupac and Snoop Dogg weren't around in Kamala's college days. Bob Marley once said, when you smoke the herb, it reveals you to yourself. But if you're running for president, maybe you should have added, just don't go there. just stay away from the
Jack,
subject.
Jack, you got something, or did Carla smoke you?
The grass is always greener.
The grass is always All right, well, this might be a tie. Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College, Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Tip typically I promote the next segment on Take Two, but with the way that ended, I think we'll just say more Take Two coming up in just a few minutes. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The Supreme Court agreed today to take up the controversial citizenship question proposed for the 2020 census and decide whether or not it can be added. The question asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? Last month, a lower court rejected the Commerce Department's plan to incorporate it into the mandated questionnaire, saying the process that led to the proposal was flawed. And the Trump administration is locked into seven legal battles with dozens of states, cities, and other groups that don't want the question added. For more, we turn now to Hanzi Lo Wong, who's been covering all this for NPR. Hanzi, welcome back.
Thank you, A.
All right. How significant is it that the Supreme Court has decided now to look at this issue?
This is a very big deal. The Supreme Court, highest court in our land, is going to look at a question that could have a really a significant impact on the 2020 census, which directly impacts how political power and how federal funding are distributed in this country over the next 10 years. This is the data. This sets the reality that the country is going to operate on. So this is going to be a very big deal what the Supreme Court decides.
And Hanzi, considering the roster of the Supreme Court right now, I'm wondering if this is exactly what the Trump administration was hoping for.
Well, if you were to look at the emails that were released as part of these lawsuits, there was one email exchange between Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau, and also one of his staffers that said this is a case that they expected to go to the Supreme Court. This is back in 2017, and so they had to be very careful, they were discussing, of preparing the record about how they decided to add this question.
Now, when will the Supreme Court hear these arguments, and when might a decision come down?
Today, the Supreme Court said they're going to set a hearing sometime in April, likely around the week of April 22nd. We're going to see exactly the timeline. And so that means a decision will be coming probably sometime in late June. That is when everyone is hoping to get a decision in order for the Census Bureau to move forward with printing of the census forms.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, because it sounds like that's getting pretty close to the wire. When do they have to have that all printed up and ready to go?
Well, the Census Bureau says it has to be printed starting this summer. So June has been the deadline everyone has been working towards. If it goes past that, then when we don't know whether or not this question is on the census form, that could get into hairy territory. We're into the final months of preparation for the 2020 census. Pushing any deadlines is going to have an impact on other things down the line and also could require additional funding from Congress.
Now, for those who have not been following this as closely as all of us have, remind us why the Trump administration thinks we need to add this question. The U.S. hasn't asked U.S. households about citizenship, what, since back 1950, right? It's been a while.
It's been close to 70 years since the Census Bureau has asked all households. There has been a citizenship question on a survey done by the Census Bureau that's gone out to a sample of households. That's now known as American Community Survey. The Trump administration says it wants a citizenship question on the 2020 census in order to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as protections against discrimination of racial and language minorities. But a federal judge in New York, U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman, has ruled, this is from his ruling last month, that that was a sham justification based on the internal emails, based on memos, depositions made by, given by the Trump administration officials as part of this lawsuit, that there was actually the former head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department testified under oath that this question was not necessary to enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so the question here is exactly why does administration want to include this question, especially when the Census Bureau was trying to encourage them to use an alternative method using existing government records and to not include a question that will disturb and risk the accuracy of the census.
And Hanzi, the argument against adding the question is that it could scare away people from even taking part in the national headcount, which they say could have lasting consequences. What would those consequences be?
Well, the concern here is that this question will discourage households with non-citizens. So that includes both citizens who may be living with someone who is an unauthorized immigrant, who is a green card holder. If we don't have a count of every person living in the country, as the Constitution requires, we're not going to have accurate population counts for states, for local communities, and then that will directly impact how the political power, specifically congressional seats and electoral college votes, and how federal funding for public services, how all that is distributed based on population counts. And so we're going to have bad data, possibly, for the next 10 years.
That's NPR's Hansi Lo Wang talking to us about the Supreme Court's decision to take up the case of the citizenship question for the census. Hansi, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, eh?
All right, now we've got a really trashy topic to cover: garbage hauling in the city of L.A., specifically commercial garbage collection for businesses, apartments, and condos. Back in July 2017, the city rolled out a new program that was designed to make L.A. a greener, cleaner place. But it was plagued with complaints: missed trash pickups, overcharges, new fees. Now the city and garbage haulers have agreed to make some changes to head off a costly lawsuit and also address those complaints. The Board of Public Works approved those contract changes earlier today. And here to explain all of it is KPCC's infrastructure correspondent, Sharon McNary. Welcome back, Sharon.
Hey there, thanks.
All right, now before we get to the approved changes, let's get a little background on what things used to be like a few years ago when people started overhauling the garbage collection system. What was the situation for apartments, condos, and businesses?
Well, for business, apartments, and condos, the trash collection system was that there was no system.
No system, all right.
It was pretty much the Wild West. There were dozens of companies. They competed with each other, and prices could be very low. And there was some regulation. Haulers had to register with the city and pay recycling fees based on how much garbage they supposedly dumped. But aside from that, it was just raw, unfettered capitalism.
What is so wrong with capitalism, Jeremy?
In this case, it created an uncoordinated situation. You might have a residential street with apartments or condos, families with kids running around, and all these different companies' garbage trucks would be rumbling by every day, several trucks a day. So there were safety and noise issues. Garbage bins would be rolled out to the street on different days, making it hard for cyclists. Those garbage trucks might be new and clean and driven by well-trained union drivers, or they could be old and dirty, and the drivers might be paid very low wages and have very little training. Also, LA did not have a uniform recycling system for apartments, condos, and businesses. So environmentalists, including the LA City Council members, wanted a commercial garbage hauling system that would be cleaner and greener with more recycling and less truck traffic in residential areas. They wanted a system where all the businesses and the multifamily buildings that created all the trash, the traffic, noise, and emissions would actually be made to pay the full cost of reducing the burdens that that trash produces.
Okay, so then the city went to this new system back in 2017 with a bit of a weird name, spelled RECYCLA. First off, how is that even pronounced? Because there were all kinds of things in the newsroom that we were kind of thinking about.
Recicla.
Recicla. Recicla. Okay, so how does it work?
So LA is the largest city to ever try this idea, and here's what they did. The city got chopped into 11 zones, and companies competed for the right to exclusively serve one or more of those areas. It's a franchise system. Seven companies won franchises, and the service rolled out in July 2017 to immediate, loud, and bitter complaints from businesses.
Now, I know people hate change, but in this system, what didn't people like?
The initial handover from dozens of companies who were losing their business to seven companies who were getting exclusive franchises, it was clumsy. And there were hundreds of missed pickups at the outset.
Oof.
The higher prices came as a big shock, and so did some of the other charges. Like, the city's rules required the winning bidders to have these clean fuel trucks and to manage recycling. So that's going to cost more than the dozens of cheaper companies that got pushed out of the city. But then the city's contract with the haulers let them charge for all kinds of add-ons. So the garbage truck driver needed to open a gate or go down a long driveway or use a key or an intercom to get into a property to get to the garbage bin. All that cost extra. Or if the apartment or condo or business contaminated their recycling bin with the wrong items or some nasty waste that spoiled the value of the recyclables, there would be more charges. And of course, there are all those missed pickups.
I can just imagine sharing the wrath of small apartment owners who have been operating at a small margin over the years, just fuming over a big new garbage bill.
And the city council members really got an earful. Some of the angriest, most bitter testimony I've ever heard came in some of the follow-up hearings about this new contract. The new system meant they could get their service from only one company, so there was no competition to keep their hauler in line. It was frustrating, and some apartment owners sued, calling the system an unfair tax. I spoke with one of those plaintiffs, Malcolm Bennett. He owns some apartment buildings and heads up the Minority Apartment Owners Association, about 500 local owners, and they own small business affordable places that are under rent control. He says many of his members were seeing trash bills increase 30 to 100%, and with the more expensive equipment and new fees for recycling bins and so on.
We don't drive Mercedes. We don't drive Lexus expensive cars because of what the interest we're in is not that big a profit margin. So we really didn't feel that we needed a Rolls-Royce trash company. We needed a company that provided service at a reasonable price.
So he says they do care about the environment, but their buildings are rent control, and they wanted to share those increases with their tenants.
Okay, so how's the city changed the program to reduce the grumbling?
Well, they're going to make the recycling free. Here's Enrique Zaldivar talking about it. He's head of the city's Bureau of Sanitation.
We will have resolved the barriers to recycling created by the extra service charges on blue container service, thus making blue recycling free to all Recycla customers.
So the Board of Public Works met today. They're going to make it free. The city and haulers would jointly refund some recycling service charges and overcharges and absorb those costs. So the bill to the city is going to be about $9 million this year, more than $7 million in subsequent years and going forward. And the city hopes to increase recycling and reduce the amount of trash going to landfills.
Really quick, Sharon, does this fix everyone's complaints?
When in civic life is everybody satisfied? Hardly ever. There's still questions about the underlying costs, and there'll always be businesses mad that they no longer have competition.
That's KPCC's infrastructure correspondent, Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
If you imagine a roller skating rink, you might think of a place where you can strap on some wheels and just glide. That's true. But historically, rinks have also been a place where African Americans express their culture. Whether it was just skating or when hip-hop acts like N.W.A. had no places to give their music a stage. Now, the thing is, roller skating rinks in urban areas are closing all over the place, especially right here in Los Angeles. Hear that story when Take Two continues.
I rode my bicycle past your window last night.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Have you ever tried roller skating? It's not so hard, really. You just strap on some skates to your feet, push off, and roll. But for some people in Los Angeles who want to skate the way they want to, listen to the music they want to, alongside the people they want to roll with, it's not so easy.
In Los Angeles County, our skate community is suffering. We have Road on Wheels that closed, Hollywood, Rosecrans, Skate Land. And tonight, the last rink that we have is closing its doors.
That's Felicia Wright. The community she's talking about is African American roller skaters. As you heard, there used to be plenty of places in LA for black people to get together and roll around. Actually, there were plenty all over the country. Not anymore, though. That's the focus of a new HBO documentary called United Skates. Deanna Winkler is one of the filmmakers. She came into the studio along with Felicia Wright. Welcome.
Hello.
All right, Felicia, let's start with you. You and your family are some of the skaters profiled in United Skates. Now, before we get to where we are now when it comes to skating, take us back a bit. In its prime, when L.A. was like the total greatest skate scene you'd ever imagine, what did it look like on the nights when it was really going off?
It was always numbers, whether it was the kids' session, family session, or the adult session. It was always just the place to be.
What kind of places in L.A.? Where in L.A. were you skating?
Growing up, it was Hollywood. My mother was one of the DJs. And then that closed down. and then it was World on Wheels from 1981 on.
Deanna, how did you find out about this kind of skate culture?
We were shooting something different in New York, and we met some younger African-American skaters who said, "No, skating's not dying, because in New York there's no rinks left." But we met these younger skaters that said, "No, it's still alive. We're trying to keep it alive. And if you want to see what we do, you got to follow us." And so we went with them on an overnight bus from New York City down to Virginia. And in the middle of the night, we walked into a rink, and it was packed. There were lines down the block, one in, one out, and everyone that we met was from somewhere else. As we began to travel and go to these different cities to document the skating that was happening there, that we always were picked up by a skater in that city, housed by a skater. We slept on their couches, their floors, their beds. We never walked in alone. We always walked in as insiders.
You were like an embedded journalist then.
Correct.
And one of the great things about United Skates, if someone is not aware or didn't know that this kind of skate scene existed, you guys go way back to kind of really tie in how the rise of hip hop really, really played into the skating scene, especially in the 80s. Let's listen to that.
In the mid to late 80s, hip hop and rap artists had no place to perform. Their music wasn't being played on the radio. The music wasn't being played on MTV. The music was shunned. The artists were shunned. Go away. Don't perform that here. So the only place that people could perform was in skating rinks.
Once again, reppin' from the City of Angels.
That's Malat Ala, journalist, talking about the connection between hip-hop and skating. Felicia, we're not talking about nobodies performing in skating rinks, right? I mean, Dr. Dre, Queen Latifah, I mean, some big names kind of just cut their teeth a bit with their acts in skating rinks. Who do you remember seeing back in the day?
Major Blige, LL Cool J, I mean, N.W.A., Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, all of them started in roller rinks. What would happen was, Broad on Wheels would have, remember the old school radio, old hip hop station, K-Day, 1580 K-Day.
K-D-A-Y, yeah.
That was it, Greg Mack.
Yeah.
So for a while, you can skate. The dances was in the middle. Then after about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, no one could skate anymore. And so I was part of what's called the World on Wheels Dancers, the Can Dance crew.
Now, Felicia, you're an Angeleno.
Absolutely.
And
born and raised
know.
Downtown L.A.
There you go. Oh, I was born in downtown, raised in Koreatown.
Oh,
so
wow.
Not that far away.
Next door.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Now, you know that in L.A., you can't go anywhere in this city and not be judged on your style choices. And that definitely included the skating rinks.
Skaters in L.A., we took the custom skate game to a whole new level.
In L.A., foot game is imperial.
I done seen tennis shoes, I done seen house shoes, I done seen bowling shoes, I done seen golf shoes. Some people use Timberlake boots.
Felicia, describe what they mean when they mean custom skate game.
Any shoe that you want on the skate.
Anything.
Okay. Anything. To those people who keep sending me the picture of the lady with the heels on skates, that is dangerous. I will never do that.
But it's possible, right?
It's possible, yeah. But it's dangerous, and I will never do it.
Talking to Felicia Wright and Deanna Winkler, the film is called United Skates. It's on HBO February 18th. Now, the style of skating, though, the actual physical act of skating, though, there's different styles all around the country.
Right.
Right after that, we find out about how L.A. skaters prefer slippery wheels because the L.A. style
has a lot
of sliding. So break that down for us. What does that mean?
So L.A. doesn't really have a style. Our main thing is the shoe game is our thing. Now, other states like Baltimore, you have snapping. But L.A., because we don't have a quote-unquote style, we take everyone's style and put some little hot sauce on it.
We do that, right? And
yeah.
We just take everyone's style and make it our own.
We take everybody, put a little hot sauce on it, do it our way.
Is L.A. to a T.
You would never put us in a box.
Yeah. How were you guys filming that, though? Because you guys were right there with the skaters. Were you guys on wheels, too?
Yes. So it was a lot of trial and error. You know, we found the fastest lenses we could. Sometimes what we would do is we would hand the camera off to a skater, and we would say, okay, follow this person around. We've set the camera, and if you stay exactly, 4 feet or 5 feet, then it'll stay in focus. But if you get any closer or any further, it's going to be out of focus. Go.
You were training filmmakers.
Yeah. And then they would go around again. We'd say, okay, so you only got the feet. So many of those tracking shots were, it was definitely a team sport.
All right, Deanna. So now to where we are now and how we got there. Because throughout the film, Dan, I kept getting the sense that been like always a passive-aggressive resistance to African-Americans at rinks.
It took us really by surprise that every rink that we went to, and we went to a lot of rinks in a lot of cities and states, they all still have white knights and black knights. They're just not called that anymore. They're called code words like top 40s night and family night.
Hip-hop night
or soul night. Yeah. Yep. You know, during the civil rights era, actually, one of the first sit-ins was a skate-in at a roller rink in Chicago.
Didn't know that.
These spaces mean a lot. And so a lot of public spaces were closing around the country for that reason. And roller rinks realized that and said, if we want to stay open and keep what we do alive, we have to keep the nights separate. So then they started using these code words.
There's also extra security. There's more police.
Man, it's crazy. It's unfortunate, but we're still going to go. But there is that sense of just not being okay with that. But we know what we got to do to get to do what we love. It sucks for us because any white knight, you're not going to have that. When a black knight, you're definitely going to have security and all kind of foolishness.
Metal detectors.
Oh, absolutely.
Patted down. I mean, it was just.
Even at Road on Wheels, they had the metal detectors for years. But for them to have the Fruit of Islam there. It's just insane.
Now, then rinks started to close. You guys show this in the movie, especially ones that serve black communities. Here's Jerry Curran, former owner of Skate Depot in Cerritos.
In the urban areas, the land values have gotten so high that people sell the rinks, or like in our situation, they don't renew our lease. The cities and municipalities, they want a Home Depot that's going to create, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales tax. They're not here to serve the public any longer. It's all about money now.
Deanna, say years from now, the situation continues to go worse. Rinks, especially in black communities, continue to close. Do you think your film might just be a sort of last historical visual record of all this? Or are you hoping that somehow this movie keeps this alive somehow?
Absolutely. There was a sense both of documenting and recording. Many of the rinks that we filmed in are gone. So, yes, on the one hand, we do hope that it is documenting something that's disappearing quickly, but also when it comes out on HBO and it has the potential to reach literally millions of homes, we hope that there will be people out there that will see this, that will fall in love with what they see and want to help us keep it alive.
Deanna Winkler is one of the co-directors of United Skates. Felicia Wright is one of the fabulous skaters in the film. United Skates is airing on HBO February 18th. Felicia, Deanna, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, now you may be a firm believer in the old saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but there are some buildings around LA that really test that belief. There's a fried chicken joint, Western and Beverly, that's being called one of the ugliest buildings in the entire city. We're going to be the judge when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. On the corner of Western and Oakwood, just north of Beverly Boulevard in Koreatown, there's an unusual-looking building.
You see jutting forms, you see cantilevered balconies, you see corrugated metal. It really is a mixture of a lot of different things going on.
That's Adrian Scott Fine, director of advocacy at the Los Angeles Conservancy, talking about a Kentucky Fried Chicken location. It's actually the KFC I used to go to as a kid, and for 30 years it's made all kinds of ugly buildings lists in LA. So earlier this week, I met Adrian at the KFC to get some history about how it came to be.
It was designed to stand out, built in 89 and 90 in kind of the constructivist form of architecture, which is a kind of an offshoot of postmodernism. So it's got lots of different bold forms, jutting geometric shapes. It's different than any other KFC in the country. It was designed to be, you know, a statement piece.
Now, we're here because Atlas Obscura called it 21 ugly buildings that aren't really ugly, and this is one of them. Now, ugly is a subjective term. I mean, what's ugly to me might not be ugly to you, but it is certainly unusual, right? I mean, if someone were to drive past this that hasn't seen it before, and they're looking like, what is this, right? And it, was that kind of the point, you think, to making this the way it is today?
Well, in some ways, my understanding is that this is kind of an outgrowth of Googie architecture, which in many ways is beloved in LA. And this isn't, I wouldn't say beloved quite yet, but it's about standing out, drawing attention to yourself, looking different than anything else. And as you're driving by, you take note of it. And if you're hungry, perhaps that also means you're going to buy some chicken. So it is definitely different than anything else around in this area.
Now, Adrian, you might not want to call a building ugly, but can you see why someone would say this is an ugly building?
Yeah, there are a lot of buildings that people deem ugly. We would probably say misunderstood, underappreciated, not knowing the story behind the building. And I think once you dig a little deeper, sometimes buildings that may on first blush seem ugly, you might start to appreciate, and especially over time. Late 80s, early 90s architecture isn't quite yet appreciated. So I say give this building another 5-10 years and you might have somebody that says they think it's pretty or really attractive.
What should people know about the particular construction of this building? I mean, I'll admit, it does seem like a lot that maybe doesn't have a function. Or you tell me, because it's my untrained eye coming up with that observation.
This style is sort of organized chaos.
Okay.
so it's hard to make sense of. But think of this as a sort of an outgrowth of, and certainly what evolved into the work of Frank Gehry. This was designed by proteges that worked in his office. And if you look at the Disney Concert Hall, which most people love,
yeah,
and think is beautiful, that's also organized chaos.
That thing is quirky too, right?
It is. But the other thing that goes with this is, it not only is it an unusual style, but it was creating an experience. So like you said, you can't go to any other KFC and have this type of experience in a second floor dining room and a balcony to kind of look off and see what's going on. I mean, that's a whole new thing in terms of what this was trying to achieve here.
And one of the things that actually surprised me when it was built is that KFC allowed this to happen. Franchises typically want uniformity. That way, one store in LA is the same as a store in New York. So the fact that they allowed this to be built, that to me was kind of a big deal. I mean, that they actually allowed it to happen.
Yeah, I don't know how this slipped by. I'm glad it did in terms of LA having this claim to fame. It's the most architect-designed KFC probably in the world, but I'm not sure that would happen today when everything is so branded and controlled, and it's nice to have something like this that does stand out and is different.
But in general, maybe people want to say, you know what, maybe I want to notice other buildings in Los Angeles that are quirky, that maybe don't fit the neighborhood, and maybe get a sense of appreciation. What areas would you suggest they go to?
All over the city. Certainly, if you're looking at other buildings from like 80s, 90s, Venice is a great place to go. We did a tour a few years ago looking at kind of the intersections between art and architecture. That's where Frank Gehry and other of his contemporary architects were kind of getting their feet wet in terms of doing designs like this. But all over the city, you have buildings like this.
What would you suggest, Adrian, that people keep in mind as they're studying these buildings, the lines, the way it was built, the way it's all put together?
Think about the era. Think about how architecture was trying to break from traditional forms. It was trying to be its own thing. And that's why you have buildings like this that maybe people don't understand or think are ugly today, but there was a reason why buildings that are kind of chaotic had a purpose and why they came about and how things evolved from there.
Do you almost wish there were more buildings like this in LA?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're going to talk about the 80s and early 90s, how can you not, tell that era and that decade without looking at buildings like this? I mean, they really do epitomize the story.
And I really like what you said there. Tell the story of that era. We do, right? Through our buildings, through what we build. Do you think nowadays designers, architects don't take enough chances like the one we were seeing in front of us right now?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It seems like the direction we go is more of functionality and not creativity in terms of leaving a legacy for this city and thinking about what are the future landmarks. And you know what they were doing here and what they were doing certainly in earlier eras was really thinking about what are we leaving behind for this city and making the mark within Los Angeles.
That's Adrian Scott Fine of the LA Conservancy. He's the director of advocacy. Adrian, thanks for meeting us out here and telling us about this building.
No, thank you. Thanks for covering this.
Okay, here we go. You raise the left arm up and the right arm too.
All right, I want to see what that bizarre KFC looks like. You can see photos at take2.org. And while you're there, let us know about any other buildings or structures you may be curious about. You're doing the funky chicken. All right, finally, let's head into the weekend by helping you plan what to do.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, some people out there might want to spend the long weekend hiding from the rain, hugging a nice stew.
It's hot, but though. It's hot.
That's why you need it. But, you know, brave the outside, and there's a bunch of cool things to do. Although this first one's indoors, curling up to read some comics. Ooh. Oh, your eyes lit up. Tomorrow and Sunday,
where?
It's the Long Beach Comic Expo. Wow. So it happens at the convention center, and you'll be able to meet illustrators, cosplayers, sellers, and more. I know you're a big Flash fan, so I bet if you go, you'll find a whole bunch of Flash swag, so that'll be cool. Bonus, this event also includes Space Expo, where there'll be some of the area's coolest scientists joining programs to explain the real science behind some sci-fi out there. So it's going to be a really great event. When you go, tickets start at $25, but if you've got kids 10 and younger, kind of like your grandkids, they get in for free.
Oh, nice. I wonder if the mayor of Long Beach is going to be there. He is a very comic book-friendly mayor.
Very possible. Yeah. Now, maybe all this cold and rainy weather has you thinking you should fatten up for winter. Yeah, do not resist that urge, because this Monday, so that's President's Day, you can live it up in Downey. This restaurant, LKSD Kitchen, it's going to be hosting a steak and whiskey tasting. So yeah, you're going to be getting steak samples.
Two for
also
me so
gnocchi,
far, yeah.
Cheesecake, and then some nice snifters of whiskey. Obviously, this is for adults only, and it's $99 per person.
$99. That's not a bad price.
No,
yeah.
Not at all. Also, this weekend, you can yes and to your heart's content. You see where this is going?
Yes.
Improv, yeah.
And?
Yes. Tomorrow in the Fairfax neighborhood of L.A., the improv comedy troupe The Groundlings opens up its doors for an open house. This is that company that's brought you great, 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 great comedy legends like Phil Hartman, Maya Rudolph, Kristen Wiig, Caitlin Olson. So for this event this weekend, there are going to be free shows throughout the day. And if you really want to, you can chip in just $10 to take an improv class while you're there, then also spend recess, as they actually call it recess, outside with beer, rolled ice cream, giveaways, and more.
I've been told, Leo, not by you, that I am a very funny person.
Yeah, definitely not by me.
All right, I'll go take the class. I'll go take the class.
And then finally, a dance party. Yeah, this is Robin. Of course, you and I both love her. And the Swedish singer has a new album out there called Honey, which came out last fall. Mm-hmm. Fans are getting together tomorrow night at the Echoplex in Echo Park for a Robin dance party. This one's called This Party Is Killing You. It won't, actually. It'll give you life. And DJs will be mixing her latest, greatest B-sides and more. Frankly, this is actually kind of a next best thing, because Robin is actually performing in LA next week, but that like sold out almost instantly.
Right away. You know.
I try to get tickets. Friends try to get tickets. Nope. Mm-hmm. I think like one person I know got them. But you can still go to this, and entry starts at $12. Now, there is actually a lot more going on here this weekend. You can check out our whole list of events on laist.com. That is laist.com.
All right, that's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, eh?
All right, that's going to do it for Take 2. We will be back Tuesday at 2 o'clock. You can find us on social media at Take 2. That's at Take 2. That's on Twitter. You can find me, Twitter, and Instagram, A. Martinez LA. That's A. Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. We'll be back, as I said, Tuesday at 2.